This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're going to be looking at Vermont in the 1970s, the counterculture, the back to the land movement, and the influx of people who shaped that era and continue to shape Vermont today. The State Historical Society has just embarked on an ambitious project to document more of what went on during those years and why Vermont attracted so many people. More than half of the big population boom Vermont saw in the 70s came from people moving here. This project is right in the beginning stages, and they're reaching out to find people who remember that time period. So if you're among them, you can tell us your story. Post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let us know what you remember about Vermont in the 70s, why you came here, how you think the counterculture movement has shaped our culture today. We're joined now by Jackie Calder, curator at the Vermont Historical Society, and Amanda Gustin, the Society's Public Programs Coordinator. Welcome to both of you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit more about the project. You're looking at communes, colleges, and a lot of different things that people were doing in the 1970s. I see you smiling, Amanda. You start. Tell us.
Sure. So we really are looking at the sum total of the decade. As you said, there was a large population increase in Vermont during that time, and quite a lot of people came from out of state. And we know that the political, social, cultural movements of that time really shaped the Vermont that we know of today. There had been a lot of longer-term systemic changes occurring throughout the 20th century in Vermont, but it seems like they really sped up in the 70s with that influx of new people, and that a lot of the things that when people think of Vermont today, the communes, the co-ops, the more liberal political side of things, really got their lift and their start in the 70s. And a lot of the people who came to Vermont stayed in the state and founded institutions that shaped the way the state is today.
Jackie Calder, hasn't this been studied, exhaustively documented? What are you hoping to find that's new?
Stories sort of pop up about every 10 years. We know that some of the people who are in communes have reunions about every 10 years, or there's some anniversary that comes up. You know, VPRs is one of them from the 70s, one of the institutions founded at that time. But what we're trying to do is sort of institutionalize and document that time period. We're finding lots of written materials and oral histories, but it's not in one spot. And a lot of things are in people's homes, photographs. A lot of these memories are in people's minds. So we're trying to document that. It'll go into our libraries, archives, and into the museum collection.
And you're actually asking people to share with you some of the artifacts of that time period, whether they're photographs or other things that were sort of important to their lives and lifestyles at that time.
Right. One of the major things we're doing is actually collecting. So whether it'll be the original photographs or scans of those, or if people actually give us their artifacts they've saved from that time period, or we borrow them. One of the things we're hoping to do at the end of the two-year period is an exhibition. So hopefully some of these things will collect and will be available for the public to see.
And Amanda, is this sort of, should we place it into the oral history kind of box here for what you guys are doing?
Part of it certainly will be. We've been working with the Vermont Folklife Center to craft a plan for doing a series of oral history interviews. I should mention that the entire project is funded by a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is a federal agency that has provided about half of our funding. And written into that grant, we have 50 oral history interviews, which is not a lot. We're hoping to do more, but that's our baseline. So that is a large portion of the project. We're going to be talking to people about their experiences, finding people who had the whole spectrum of experience. But there is also that material cultural aspect, as Jackie was mentioning, T-shirts. We keep hearing about all these old stoves that people had that they didn't quite know how to use yet when they moved up to Vermont in the bitter, bitter cold of those 70s winters.
And farming... do you have one yet, a stove?
I don't know, Jackie.
Do we have a stove, Jackie?
We don't have one of the standard ones. I forget what the name brand is. Someone will probably call and tell us about the brand they have. We don't actually have, we have a model of a Vermont Castings stove. Their first models, again, Vermont Castings is a company that developed in the late 1970s from someone who saw the need for a really efficient stove. So I forget what the name of their first stove is, but we probably could acquire one of those.
Yeah. And you were going on, Amanda.
Yeah, so material culture things that people might not think are part of history and are important for an historical society, especially us as the State Historical Society, to collect, to continue research forward. And then there is also a sort of more traditional archival aspect of the research. As Jackie said, a lot of the information is out there in various archives, and part of what we'll be doing is visiting those archives, looking for materials. We know there is an incredible wealth of material just at the state archives alone. So we have quite a job to do, both traditional research, oral history research, and that material culture aspect.
You're right, as I said at the beginning of this project, it's a two-year project, and you're reaching out to people and getting stories and asking people to tell you what they remember and bring you their artifacts. And I understand, Jackie, you already held one forum at Goddard College.
Yes.
What was that like? Describe it.
We had about 45 people come, and we basically had ideas on the wall of what they might remember. And so they would come up to us and say, well, you didn't have this on there, like... We were listing the communes, and unfortunately, we didn't put New Hamburger on there. And so that was one that was going on there, and some of the events. But everybody, we asked people to come up and tell their stories. And, you know, they ranged from, you know, the usual keeping warm in the winter, people who lived in teepees and those stories, to Peter Schumann getting up and saying how, you know, they were out on the road. And one of the big events that happened at that time was the Attica riots, and he talked about going out there with his troop to do some protests. And an interesting comment was that they were looking for 40 college students to represent the 40 people who died at Attica. And he said he went to a local college, and the kids there weren't even aware of what was going on. So, you know, that sort of, so many people think of college students as being the base of this, and certainly many of them were, but there's also the usual sort of self-centered, very self-directed headset of people who were young at that time that were very focused on their own lives, and his was just a great story that sort of illustrated that.
Well, listeners, if you're thinking you have your own story and you'd like to share it, we'd love to hear from you today. If you came to Vermont in the 70s, what drew you here? Did you participate in the counterculture movement? We're talking about that today as we explore why the Vermont Historical Society is so excited about a two-year project they've just embarked on that aims to document and analyze that particular period in Vermont history. And again, we would love to hear from you. Tell us your story and how you see that era's influence on Vermont today. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts or your photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to John, who's calling in from Stratford. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. I came to Vermont in 1970 to do 2 years alternative military service, and I spent that time organizing co-ops, recycling centers, doing setting up health screening. When I got done, I served as a marketing manager for the Organic Farmers Association for a season, and later worked as a VISTA volunteer, again working on co-ops. I think the thing that I wanted to bring up was how, not only how Vermont was changed by people, but how people that came here were changed themselves by Vermonters and Vermont. I think for many of us, coming out of the civil rights and anti-war movement, it was a difficult time as young people. And Vermont provided space where we could not only heal ourselves, but space in which we could experiment with our ideas. And one of the things that is a traditional value of Vermont is tolerance. And by gum, let's see, go ahead and try it. See how it works. You know, I think, you know, we found older Vermonters, we're sort of bemused with things and what people are trying. But we're provided the space to allow people to do stuff. You know, the other thing that people quickly learned was that Vermont is a hard place to live and that you need to depend upon your neighbors. And finally, you know, I think one thing that many of us learned to appreciate was the incredible amount of community and structure of government that allowed for so much public participation by everybody. And I guess, you know, as much as people, the counterculture affected Vermont, I think for many of us who came here and stayed, we were deeply affected by the people we met and the place we came to.
John, thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate hearing your story and you taking us back to that time and also tying it into what you think its effect was on how we live today. Thank you for that. Let's go to Isabella, who's in Rochester. Hi, Isabella. Go ahead.
This is Isabella. I know people always waste a lot of time thanking you and everything, so I'm not going to do that. But this is Isabella Fisk McFarlane, or Lady Bell Fisk, and I spoke to one of you, too, at the Vermont Historical Society a while back, but somehow I didn't get to get up to Goddard. But we were here. Quarry Hill in Rochester was here for 30 years prior to the arrival of the onslaught of the hippies, and I remember seeing the papers saying, the hippies are coming, and we were saying, well, I don't know if they've noticed, but we're here. And then when they came, a lot of people came in the 70s. We were just engulfed by millions of people. It swelled our ranks immensely, and then, you know, we lived together for a long, long time and had a very happy existence that was also difficult at times. And then a lot of people went out, and some founded businesses such as Vermont Soap Company and Dog Mountain. Stephen Hunick lived with us for a long time in the 60s and then left for a while in the 70s. And I, you know, a million stories. So if there's anything I can tell you, I'd be happy to.
Thank you so much for calling in, Isabella. Nice to hear from you. Jackie and Amanda, is that the kind of story you're interested in hearing from?
Yes. It's interesting that she mentioned the hippie invasion, because there was a real concern here, especially in 1971. There was an article written in the Rutland Herald picking up, I think, on something that came out of the Yale Review of Law and Social Action that talked about how, because the voting age had changed to 18, the median age of people in the United States was 27, so most people were younger. And this article talked about how if enough population got to a state with a low population, they really could take over. And so there was an article published again in the Rutland Herald saying that 50,000 hippies were expected. And Governor Dean Davis at the time didn't respond, you know, forcefully enough, and he was inundated with comments from people that he had to respond to about this hippie invasion, because it was people were really scared that 50,000 new people were going to come here. And so he actually had, Amanda has the press release he finally had to put out to calm people's fears about this, basically saying, okay, there's really nothing we can do, but we're going to, if you know, they have to obey the law once they get here. And of course, 50,000 people never came, but 5,000 to 10,000 people came.
You want to read us one of the lines from that, Amanda?
I do, because I think this press release, which is dated May 19, 1971, is just a masterpiece of political word crafting. So it begins, "It has become apparent that speculation about the so-called hippie influx this summer is causing mounting concern around the state." He continues, "I must emphasize that we have no reliable information regarding the number of young transients who may come to Vermont this summer. There are indications, however, that the number is higher than at this time last year," and he continues to say, "there's basically nothing I can do other than make sure they follow the existing laws," and he finally concludes, "Like most people, the bulk of the young transients go about their business in a self-sufficient, peaceful manner, although their habits and appearance may not be to our taste." And he finally says, "In other words, the situation is well in hand."
So basically, I got it under control. Yeah. Stop bugging me, people.
Yes.
We're okay. You know, Lady Fisk mentioned that she'd be interested in talking to you. And maybe this is a good time, Jackie, to explain how people can get involved in this project beyond just telling stories here. You have a questionnaire that you're asking people to fill out. You have a lot of upcoming meetings, community forums where people can share their stories and tell you guys what you should be focusing on that maybe you hadn't even thought of yet.
Right. We have a survey that's online. You can go to our website, vermonthistory.org, and you'll see in the lower right-hand corner a peace sign. And just you can click on that, and that'll give you information about how to take our forum. And so far,
take the questionnaire.
It's a survey that people are answering. We have over 400 people that have answered so far. And then we are having community forums around the state, and the schedule will be there, but we're having them in Hardwick, Burlington, St. Johnsbury, Brattleboro, Norwich, and Rutland in April. So go to that website, and it'll give the specific locations and times.
And Amanda, you're not actually just asking people who feel like they were a part of the Back to the Land movement or the counterculture movement in the 70s. So people who were around at that time and didn't participate, didn't want to participate, or were young or were old, or just have a perspective on what it was like to be here and not participate in that movement, are also welcome to come to the forums and to fill out the survey.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really looking for anyone who was in Vermont in the 1970s, whether you were all the way into the counterculture and living on a commune and part of the founding of a co-op, or whether maybe you already lived here and were a multiple generation Vermonter who saw people come in. And you were on the edges of the counterculture. You saw the impact of the counterculture. It's interesting. One of the questions in that survey is, did you consider yourself part of the counterculture? And a lot of people are indicating no. They did not necessarily consider themselves part of the counterculture. But then they're still checking off boxes for things like, I was involved in an early buyers group, for things like getting brown rice, which you couldn't necessarily get at the supermarket. Or I was involved in some early social movements. A lot of what we're seeing is there's the counterculture, and then there's the impact of the counterculture, and a sort of like a trickle down of that counterculture that ended up impacting Vermont across the board, whether you considered yourself part of it or not. But you know, we're also seeing reactions against counterculture, not just at that time, but still today now. People who feel that Vermont, we know that it changed Vermont, and there are people who certainly feel it did not necessarily change Vermont for the better.
We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. We're talking with Jackie Calder and Amanda Gustin from the State's Historical Society about their project looking at the counterculture movement in Vermont in the 1970s. And if you want to share your thoughts on that, on how Vermont has changed, whether you think it's positive or negative, we'd love to hear it. We're also going to hear from musician John Gailmore about why he chose Vermont in just a few moments and hear from more of you on your stories. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts, maybe post your photos if you've got them, on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're taking a look at how Vermont's counterculture movement in the 1970s has influenced the state. We're talking with Jackie Calder and Amanda Gustin from the Vermont Historical Society. They're sharing what they've heard so far out of their request for stories from that era, and we're reaching out to those of you in our listening audience who remember those days as well. If you moved here in the 1970s as part of the Back to the Land movement, you can tell us what motivated you and what you think are the lasting impressions of that time. And if you were here then but perhaps grew up here and weren't part of the counterculture, share your thoughts too. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can write down your thoughts and go to vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition to post them there. Spot says, my experience with Vermont's counterculture begins before I was born. My mom went to the Putney School in the late 30s. She worked for Phil Chase's Hickory Ridge summer camp in 1950. The Korean conflict led Dad to leave his job in Maryland and join us in Vermont. He was involved with Hickory Ridge as a handyman and fill-in teacher. There was much contact with Putney and the Center for International Living as well. From 63 to 67, I studied at Marlborough College, one of the birthplaces of the 70s counterculture. After 2 years in the Navy, I landed in Stowe, where I was part of the scene for two enjoyable years. I never felt out of place in the state. The cultural change felt like a natural evolution. Grace in Barnett says, I'd like to acknowledge the efforts of my old friend Leslie Rowell, who helped recruit participants and was also a player in the events of that era. Leslie attended Goddard College and the Institute for Social Ecology and was a VISTA worker for the Montpelier Farmers Market and Vermont Northern Growers Co-op. I worked with her back in the late 70s and early 80s when I did a number of projects for NOFA Vermont, including organizing its first organic certification program. And let's hear from Daniel, who's calling in from Dummerston. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling in from Dummerston, Vermont. That previous song you just played reminded me I'm leaving the cities. That's basically what I did. I had a professional life in Detroit, and having grown up on a farm and in a small town previous to that, I just felt like, man, I've got to get out of this. I got to get out of the city. I got to start working with my hands and not just my head. I need to live with people. So I made a big break with my life in the mid-70s. I left and I visited a lot of communes, Twin Oaks in Virginia, East Wind in Arkansas, and several others. And I wound up living in a commune in southern Missouri, Ozarks, where I lived for a year until it folded up. And I came to Vermont, actually visiting a friend, and I came passing through Brattleboro, and I was just struck by the nature of this town. I mean, they had a little company that was making solar, hot water heating units, and I eventually got a job there. And then I met this couple, Paul and Dorothea Stockwell, who were talking about their place out on Bonnievale Road. It's called the Bonnievale Learning Center. They invited me out there. This was in 1979, and I lived there for almost 20 years. It wasn't a commune, but it was just a wonderful place where we all had our own living units on about 100 acres of land. But we could come together at a common space for our meals and our, just hanging out, bathrooms and so forth, And to me, it was an ideal way of living, and it was very inexpensive. And a lot of people came and went. Some people stayed. I stayed there for a long time. But it allowed us to basically work at what our passion was. And I really started getting politically involved as soon as I started living there. And others did as well. Some people had market gardenings that they did, and they were selling their products. Other people were involved in crafts. But you didn't have to hold down, a full-time job. You could work at what your passion was, and your life evolved out of that. And we helped to fix up the place. I worked, when things broke down, plumbing, electrical, whatever, I worked on it. Other people did the same thing. And it was very low cost, and it allowed us to do anything we wanted, with our lives. And I hate to see something like that go. Both Paul and Dorothea Stockwell, they died, and now it's now the Bonnievale Environmental Education Center, which is a good thing. But, it's sad to see so many communes that were once here, no longer here. We were not communal. We did not share income in that sense, but we shared gardening. We got the wood together for heating. We shared a lot of meals together. Dorothea Stockwell was a Rogerian therapist. We had meetings every week. Sometimes if we couldn't solve our problems in the meetings, her skills allowed us to, work out our problems. And of course, they got older and they died, and the land changed hands. But it was just a wonderful place to live, and I'd encourage that to happen anywhere.
Well, Daniel, let me pick up right there, because that's an interesting point, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Jackie Calder, what about the communal living arrangements or the collectives in Vermont in the 70s has carried through to today? Daniel's saying, it's a sad thing to see some of them go by the wayside, and certainly some of them are gone. So what do you think is the legacy of that kind of communal living that was happening in the 70s?
Most of them are gone. I mean, we've documented 45. Some people say there were 60 at the time, of the hippie scare. They said there were 100. And they were all different. They all had a different reason for forming. Some of them were just a bunch of college roommates coming and living in a house for a while. Some of them had, 10 to 30 people who were very much politically active. There was a whole movement in Vermont called Free Vermont, where we know activists came, and they were in a variety of communes throughout the state. Earthworks up in Franklin County, Mount Philo in Ferrisburg, Red Clover down in the Putney-Brattleboro area. And they were organized. They communicated with each other. They're very active in the anti-war movement. helping draft resistors, moving people through and up to Canada, getting co-ops started. I mean, very politically active. And then there were, you know, people who were just writers getting together. They just didn't survive the way they were, just because a lot of times people grew up, they had families, they moved on. I think the legacy is that a lot of those people who came here stayed here. They became involved in their communities. They started working. We know a lot of people that indicate they were teachers. They became social workers, psychologists, doctors, entrepreneurs. That's a big component of the people from that time period here. But I guess most importantly, they became involved in their communities and, you know, became selectmen, part of the PTA, PTO, took on a lot of those jobs in their communities. And you don't have to scratch the surface very hard to find people who would have considered themselves part of the counterculture movement that are still here.
We got a note from Susan who sent a photo to us and says she's attached a photo. She says, it's me and my boyfriend, now husband, John, back in the day, on the porch of our one-room cabin. We still live on the same land in Andover. And yes, John is still playing the same tunes. Susan writes, throughout the 70s, I picked apples for a living on seasonal hippie apple picking and pruning crews. We were a seasonal tribe living communally during the 4 to 6 week harvest season each fall, and sometimes to prune during the winters. By working all day every day for those short periods of time, I was able to earn the few thousand dollars I needed to survive the rest of the year when I lived on various subsistence farms, protested against nuclear power plants, dug clay to make pottery, hitchhiked around, spun wool, and strove to make the most of whatever I needed by hand. Although I was born in Vermont, John arrived here in 1978 to pick apples at Scott Farm in Brattleboro on a crew which included numerous accomplished fiddle players. At the crack of dawn, they would play a set of rousing old-time music, infusing themselves and the rest of our group with the courage to go outside to work in the frost-covered orchard. And I want to let you know, we actually posted Susan's photo to our Facebook page, so you can see Susan and John back in the day, as she says there. And let's hear from Russ, who's on the line from Chelsea. Hi, Russ. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I did not live on a commune myself, but I was in contact with several of them. And for me, the 70s was a period of tremendous experimentation and learning about a whole range of different lifestyles. I took part in fire walks, in Native American sweats, but one of the things that I appreciated the most was your first caller talked about the tolerance of Vermonters. And one of the things that I really found the most surprising was the fact that there was a real connection between these newcomers doing their back to the land experiences and the old traditional Vermont farmers. They were very, very different politically. They had very different value systems. But both of them really appreciated the land and had a love of the land. And there was a tremendous connection between those two groups. The old people really taught myself and a number of my friends a lot of about the traditional ways of doing things, of canning, of logging, of working with the land with horses. It was one of the, for me, the best parts of that period.
Thank you so much for the call, Russ. I appreciate that. And let's go right to Gordon in Killington. Hi, Gordon. Your thoughts?
Yes, I grew up in Londonderry, Vermont in the 70s. And although I'm the youngest of eight kids, my sisters and brothers were part of the movement here in Vermont and had encouraged my parents to move here. And my father actually had built a house in Londonderry and were waiting for me to be born in Connecticut before they moved. And what I wanted to point out was that it was an incredible quality of life that I think that my sisters and brothers had spoken to my parents about, and that if they wanted to raise me, their last child, and to move to Vermont and just experience such a wonderful thing. We lived on Landgrove Road in Londonderry, and my backyard was 20 acres. I had a stream. My neighbor had a sawmill. He lived to be 90. He ran the sawmill when he was 90. He was an incredible inspiration to me in my life and showing me just how resourceful Vermonters could be. He built his house. It only had 6-foot ceilings because himself and his wife were both short and they wanted to save on heat. And that has, I'm a builder now, and I although I haven't built any houses with 6-foot ceilings, it showed me that, you know, Vermont was just an incredible place to be raised and the quality of life that my parents were seeking here.
Gordon, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. As somebody who lives with some people who are over 6 feet tall, I think, boy, that could be a tough sell. But what an interesting story. Thank you for sharing it. We heard from Ron, who says, our family moved to Vermont in the early 70s because of my teaching interest in Vermont Design for Education, a progressive initiative that was a child-centered and meaningful approach to elementary education. It was counter to the prevailing culture of education at the time. And Jackie, at the very beginning of the show, you were talking about stoves, and we have heard from some people who have an idea of what stove you might be talking about, what it was called. John wrote in to say it's Ashley stoves, he thinks. And yep, we're getting nods here. Yeah. He says Ashley was the stove many of us used in the early 70s. It was advertised in the Whole Earth catalog. And that, of course, prompted our own news director, John Dillon, to write in, who says, I still have an Ashley stove in my garage. In our communal house, the stovepipe for the Ashley stretched horizontally across the living room. Total fire hazard.
That's come up a couple of times.
The fire hazard part,
the fire hazard part of people not entirely knowing how to handle these stoves.
Well, yes, I think that's probably not recommended to do it that way. No. We're talking about the 1970s. We're talking about Vermont in the 70s, the counterculture movement, the back to the land movement. We're trying to tease out as well how it influenced the Vermont we know today. If you'd like to share your thoughts on that, if you see connections between the 70s and today in Vermont's culture, politics, landscapes, family structures, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a photo or a story on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We are spending the hour with Amanda Gustin and Jackie Calder from the Vermont Historical Society. They're heading up a big new project that aims to collect stories and impressions from Vermonters who participated in or were around during the Back to the Land movement in the 1970s and who can help us understand how that era helped to shape what Vermont has become today. And we're hearing from a lot of you. So many of you remember that time period, have thoughts you want to share. You can go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and post your thoughts there. You'll also see there more information on how to get involved in this specific project that the Historical Society is doing, including filling out their survey. If you want to share your thoughts with us on air, you can also call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Bert's calling from the road. Hi, Bert. Go ahead.
Hello, hello. Thank you for taking the call. What a wonderful project. I was curious, I'm not calling to share a story, and I can follow up with the Historical Society directly about this, but I thought you might speak to ways that you have to collect information from folks, whether it's in print, on Facebook, as you mentioned, other recordings that exist already, and if there's any preferences for people who are willing to collect and send things in.
Yeah, Bert, your line was a little bit rough there at the end, so let me translate for people who also may be on the road and couldn't quite hear you. Bert's asking about how are you collecting all of this stuff? Are you doing audio? What are the different ways that you're getting it? And what about other people helping you out? So, Amanda, maybe you can explain a little bit more details about how the project is working.
Yeah, thanks, Bert. So the first thing I do want to mention is that Leslie, who was mentioned earlier, Leslie Rahl, is actually going to be working with us on this project. She's one of our field interviewers, which leads me into describing that. So the survey that we're mentioning on our website is sort of an initial point of contact. It's giving us names, places, events, ideas. You know, we don't know what we don't know. So we're trying to keep digging and keep finding out more. Out of that survey, we're developing a set of criteria for those. As I mentioned earlier, we have grant funding to do 50 oral history interviews, which we have two field interviewers doing. Leslie and Kate Blofson is our other field interviewer. So we will establish criteria to do those full oral history interviews, but we've gotten such a great response. We're trying so hard to find ways to collect even more information, and we're doing a lot of thinking and talking about that right now. It may be that we sit down with a couple of specific communities and do a sort of a story circle kind of recording. It may be that people send us in their own narratives and memories and things like that. We're also recording these forums that we're doing because a lot of stories are coming up through those as well. In terms of objects and things like that, Jackie's really expert on that and can talk about what we're looking for and how we're getting it.
One of the things we are getting quite a bit of are stories. People have written their own memoirs or their stories about very specific points in their life. So we are collecting those. We'll be printing them off, also keeping them in a digital format, and working with Paul Carnahan, our librarian, on that. Again, all these materials we're collecting, T-shirts, bumper stickers, I was thinking about waterbeds. There's so many artifacts from that time period. The artifacts we're looking for, we're hoping really can tell a story and that we can use in the exhibit, not just sort of something mass-produced that doesn't have a connection to Vermont. But again, they'll go into our archive. They'll go into our museum collection. They'll be available in the future for future researchers. Obviously, it's going to be the final programs we have are just going to be the tip of the iceberg. But the part that's under water will be part of our collection. So in the future, hopefully people don't have to come back and collect all of this again. Or we'll have collected the stories of people 50 years from now, people still want to hear.
I'm imagining now the Historical Society being inundated with old waterbeds and hoping
only
that
doesn't
happen.
We'll only take one
with a good story.
That's right. Of course, the music industry was also changing at the time, and we actually asked musician John Gailmore, who's very well known in Vermont, to recall how he was attracted to the state in the 70s.
I knew I wasn't ready to be a soloist, so I got together with a high school friend, and we formed a duo for 2 years. His name was Rob Carlson, and we toured the country and sang in colleges and coffee houses and signed with this company in New York and did a record with Polydor Records in 1973. Experienced the big time, which was really repugnant to me, and my partner felt differently, so we broke up. Then I went to Europe for 2 years. I needed to leave the country because that was it. That was the last straw. The music business turned me off, and I had to go. And there was Vietnam that was in the mix too, and I just didn't want to be here anymore. So I went to Europe for 2 years, lived there, and sang in clubs occasionally, and traveled and waited on tables, then came back to the States and started a solo career. I was ready. And when it came time to choosing a place, my partner and I had sung in a lot of different places around the country, in colleges and towns and cities. And a lot of beautiful places, a lot of great people, but something about Vermont stuck with me. I just remembered the people. I remembered the people and the land, and the whole picture was something I just had to be a part of.
Lazy one, you just sit there singing all day long with your harmony. Crazy one, don't you know your strumming leaves me humming? Days fly by and my life gets shorter. I don't much care about the time I lose. I had this dream that the world was easy. All was simple, all was slow. Sing.
That was one of the first songs, maybe the first song I ever wrote in Vermont. And it was about, here I am, and now what am I going to do? And why did I come here? And I need to sing, and I have this dream of living in the country with cows and a goat, a couple of sheepdogs, and me. And the first two dogs I ever had were sheepdog mixes, Randy and Ned. So a lot of that came true, and I'm singing and still singing, and I always will. So that's what that song is about. It's just a real snippet of why I'm here.
My soul with the clouds floating by. Just cows and a goat, a couple of sheepdogs and me. Alive and alone in a field overgrown.
That's John Gailmore and his song Lazy One. Nice to hear his reflections there. And more music from the era. And, of course, many kids growing up in Vermont familiar with John Gailmore from county fairs all through the 70s and 80s. Great to hear him. We're talking about Vermont in the 1970s. We're talking about the counterculture movement. And we're talking with the Historical Society about why they're looking into this time period and what they hope to find. Amanda Gustin, I'd love to ask you, you know, we've heard from some of the callers who talk about agricultural movements and learning from farmers in the 70s, older farmers who were already here and weren't coming for the counterculture movement, but were established established farmers here. You know, we talk now a lot about organic farming. We talk about being close to our food sources, knowing our farmers. We talk about local food movements. Do you see connections directly back to the land movement of the 70s there?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of those food systems and a lot of the thinking about those food systems does come right out of the 70s. NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, is founded right in the middle of the 70s. All of those food co-ops, and we're not talking just about the storefront co-ops, we're talking about the sort of farmer side co-ops as well as the buyers groups, which are where a lot of those co-ops get their start. They come directly out of the 70s and still influence Vermont today.
Jackie Calder, what about politics? Do you see our politics today still being shaped by what the people who came here in the 70s brought to us?
Definitely. Talking about food, I mean, one of the serious issues that started happening in the 70s was the oil embargo. And even in Vermont, they were finding all the farmers were going out of business, and Vermont was importing a lot of its food. And so a lot of the newcomers were sort of saying, you know, I don't want to buy this corporate food and big chain supermarkets. And so the state started to listen, and then it started to impact people financially. The cost of food was going up. So there was something called the Vermont Commission on Food under Governor Salmon's administration that started looking at those issues. So, yeah, definitely directly tied to politics. A lot of policy issues came up that the government started paying attention to.
Amanda, do you think you could do this work in any other state and find the same things? Or was there something different about Vermont in the 70s? I mean, we like to think we're exceptional, but really.
Yeah, the question of sort of essentialism, exceptionalism, those are big picture history kind of questions. Vermont definitely stands out. In this time period, we had someone talk about a map that features Berkeley, California, New York City, and Plainfield, Vermont as places to go for counterculture. You can hear similar stories in other parts of the country, but I do think that there is something different and something original about the stories we're hearing in Vermont.
That's Amanda Gustin. We've also been talking with Jackie Calder. They're both with the Vermont Historical Society, and they're leading up this project, a two-year project about Vermont in the 70s, counterculture, back to the land, and the lasting influence those movements had on our culture today. We have information at vpr.net for people who are interested in learning more or in taking their survey. And you can continue to share your stories there. We've been loving hearing all of your stories from the 70s. We may be able to read a few in a mailbag segment, but please continue posting and read up on the conversation there. Jackie and Amanda, thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, we take on stress. Being stressed out seems to be a catchphrase these days for anyone with any amount of pressure in their lives. But chronic stress can have severe repercussions on a person's body. We'll take a look at what the long-term effects are and how you can lessen the amount of stress in your life. Send your questions or comments about stress to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.